We're looking at chapter 12. We are not going to get very far tonight, but I'm going to read verses 1 through 6. And I'm not sure how far we'll get because I'd like to engage you guys in some conversation and look at maybe something that you might not have seen before, or maybe you have. But let's look at the text. And again, I'm going to start from my translation. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. And a great sign appeared in the heaven, a woman cast about her with the sun and the moon underneath her feet, and upon her head was a crown of 12 stars. And she having in her belly a baby, and cried in birth pains, and tormented to give birth. And appeared another sign in the heaven, and behold, a great fiery dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head were 7 diadems. And his tail swept the third of the stars of the heaven and cast them into the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, the one about to give birth, so that when her child should give birth, he should eat it up. And was given birth a male son, which is about to shepherd all the nations with an iron rod. And her child was snatched away to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the desert, where she has there a place prepared for her from God, so that he should nourish her 1260 days. All right, now I mentioned, I think last Wednesday at Bible study, that there's a famous statement that if you tell somebody your interpretation of the woman in chapter 12, then I can tell you, he says, tell me your interpretation of the woman in Revelation 12, and I'll tell you your interpretation of prophecy. So I'll start and I'll ask you guys, who is this woman? Who is she? That is what I said. Is that what you would normally conclude just from reading this? Yeah, a lot of people, Catholic scholars, a lot of Catholic scholars believe that this is referring to Mary, and there are pretty much, those are really the two answers that people go with, are Mary and the woman. I think some people have talked about the woman being the church or just the people of God in general, but those are kind of the two or three answers that seem to keep cropping up. But when you look at this, we ask, well, what is this description? Why do we have these? We'll get to the other ones, these other symbolic people who are here, because chapter 12 has 7 major characters. So when we look at chapter 12, we see the first major character is the woman. And all of these are symbolic characters. All of these are we have the woman, we have the child, we have the dragon, we have Michael and the angels, and then moving forward, we also have the beast, and we have, moving past chapter 12 into the later sections, we have the beast. Who do we have else? I think we have the beast from the sea, and I think Whore Babylon is brought in here as well. But there are, it's generally agreed that there are 7 major characters, and I might be missing one here, but right here in chapter 12, at least in the section that we're looking at, you have God, obviously, but of these symbolic characters, you have the woman, the child, and the dragon. Now, the text is really clear that we have the dragon. We know who it is. It's Satan. So if we were to go a little bit forward, we have in verse 9, and the great dragon, who is ancient or from the beginning, and he's called the devil and Satan. He's the deceiver of the whole world. I mean, John is making sure we understand who the dragon is. And when he does that, he's reminding us that these are symbolic characters, that the woman is not necessarily a single woman, and that probably the child could be a child, could be a male child, but isn't necessarily a single child. So with kind of that, Jim, I am assuming you're agreeing with your wife. I don't know for sure, but So so why is there this description that she's clothed with the sun, with the moon underneath her feet, and upon her head was a crown of 12 stars? Why is that the description?
No.
There are 12 tribes of Israel. Yep, absolutely. There are 12 tribes of Israel. Any other guesses? There are also 12 apostles. So we've got the number 12. What's that? Well, we are, but I'm saying when we look at the number 12, we say, okay, well, if we're going to try to figure out who we're talking about, we'll say the number 12. What could the number 12 refer to? And we would look at all the significant 12s in the Bible, and we would say, oh, okay. But since we believe, we're just going to start with the premise that we're talking about the nation Israel. We'll say, okay, when we consider Israel, where is 12 significant? Okay, well, the 12 tribes, even though they were technically 13. We have the 12 tribes. But we have this description, and it's pretty significant. Now, if we go back to Genesis, and we go back to, I think, chapter... Oh, okay. Look at you with your notes, paying attention. Yeah, yeah. So when we look at chapter 37, Joseph has his dream, and in one of his dreams, he tells his father that we were in a field and we were tying up bundles, and my bundle stood up and all the other bundles gathered around it and bowed low before it. And so they say, oh, well, that's interesting. You know, who do you think you are, buddy? And they didn't really appreciate it. And then he told them another dream in verse 9. He says, listen to this dream. He said, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed low before me. Okay, so John uses this description about the woman being clothed in the sun, the moon is underneath her feet, and upon her head is this crown of 12 stars. So it's very similar to the description that we have here, but it's not exactly the same. So it's similar, but not the same. All right, so we've got the head, she's clothed with the sun, she has the moon underneath her feet. There's a crown of 12 stars. There is, just FYI, I don't know if you guys have seen the documentary about the Bethlehem Star, but this guy, I forget his name, Larson, I think is his last name. He's a lawyer, but he got really into astronomy. And he wanted to find out what the Star of Bethlehem was. And so he set these parameters about what he was studying. And he said, well, I'm going to look for something that follows all of the descriptions that Matthew gives when he describes the nativity star. It's a star that rises in the east, that it travels, you know, with them, that it leads them towards Jerusalem. And that when they came to Jerusalem, it stopped, the star stops over Bethlehem. And that's, so he takes these steps and he says, okay, well, what could this star be? And he begins to kind of plot through the stars, and he comes up with what he thinks would have been significant enough for people to find. If you haven't seen it, I would really recommend watching it. There has been some criticism of his work. I think it's called the Bethlehem Star. Oh, Larson, I believe. He's got his own website. You can go, and you can watch the video on YouTube for free. It's really well done. I think he makes a pretty good case, but he also says that he has a theory about this, which is that on the day of the crucifixion, that it would not have been visible to people. It would not have been visible to humans because of, you know, how stars, and it would have been too early. But at sunrise, On the day of Jesus' crucifixion, there was Virgo, the woman, the constellation Virgo, which the Jews had a constellation, they recognized that the constellation for Virgo was a woman. There's actually a guy named E.W. Bollinger talked about the Maseroth, which was the Jewish, basically the Jewish zodiac. And it's really interesting. He says some, if you find the book, read it for yourself. I don't know that I would go hog wild on what he says, but he says some interesting things. Well, anyways, the Jews had their own version of the zodiac, and they recognized Virgo as being the virgin woman. And on the day of Jesus' crucifixion, there was, as the sun rose, Virgo was rising underneath of the sun, or Virgo was in the sun, and the moon was beneath it. It was one of those weird days where the moon would have been, you know, following the sun, trailing the sun with because of the rotation, or maybe the I don't know. I'm not an astronomer, but anyways, that's his theory. He's saying that's what John saw. Well, that might be what John saw. John might have seen that constellation. But I think that it's simpler here for purposes of looking at Johannine theology to say, okay, John doesn't just point at this and say, hey, there was this sign in the heavens. Okay, well, he's saying there's a sign in the heavens, and that sign in the heavens was this constellation that happened on the day of Jesus' crucifixion. Very well could be, very well may have been intended by God, but this isn't just saying that there was something in the sky. He's saying that there was something that is going to have impact. And so you would say, well, Luke, well, why is the description of you know, a sign occurred in the heavens, that this happens in the heavens? I would say that if nothing else, there are a lot of references to the stars, you know, that there is as innumerable as the stars of the sky. You know, look at the stars and count them. If indeed you can count them, so shall your sons be. And that's a promise that God makes to Abraham. So, you know, I can't give you a perfect answer. Maybe Mr. Larson has a point. Maybe that's part of what's being referenced here. I don't know how anybody would have ever interpreted that, because it would have been a constellation that would have been invisible. And I don't think that's the purpose of Revelation, is to give a whole lot of information that nobody could have sorted out for themselves. But, you know, hey, maybe. Anyways, so the woman has this crown. And again, it's probably a reference, most likely, to Genesis, the Genesis narrative. And so if we accept that the woman is pregnant, that the woman is Israel, she's going to give birth. And she's got this belly in her baby, she's in birth pains, and she's tormented. Now, notice that, just for fun, just pay attention, that she cried in birth pains, and she was tormented. I mean, there are several descriptions here that kind of seem to be piling it on, that there was something causing pain and distress and misery. And then there's another sign in the heaven. Now, I'll just pause right here and say, a sign doesn't necessarily mean a symbol. The Greek word semion normally means a symbol. It normally means, it can also mean a miracle. And when we look at John's usage of the word sign, it probably most likely means a miracle. So there was a miracle in heaven. There's a miracle in heaven. And so, again, are we saying that you should look to the skies to see this miracle, or is this a sign that came by heaven, because the word en in Greek can mean by? It's really confusing language. It's hard to figure out exactly what's being intended. But there's a dragon, and this dragon has 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head were 7 diadems. I translated that word diadem specifically, one, because that is the word, but also to distinguish it from the word Stephanos, however you want to pronounce that, that we see earlier when Jesus talks about the crowns that those who overcome will receive crowns. So it's a different word. The word diadem is typically a word that in the Greco-Roman world, a diadem is a crown that is made of metal, or some other something, you know, just metal, pretty much metal, and it's not gonna fade, it's not gonna break. A Stephanos is a victor's crown, and typically those were laurels. And so obviously they would fade and they would, you know, fall apart because they're just plants, and they don't last necessarily. So diadems were used more for royalty, and Stephanoi, Stephanoses were used for crowns of victory, like at Olympic Games and stuff like that. So anyways, so we've got this woman described. We have the dragon described, and obviously the 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 diadems, we've seen language like this before, we've seen descriptions like this before. This is clearly bringing us back to Daniel, it's bringing us to other passages where we have descriptions of Satan. And his tail swept the third of the stars of the heaven and cast them into the earth. Okay, so what are the stars? Oh, well, okay, well, it could be. So that's a really interesting take on that. So if the crown, If the stars are from the head of the woman, that's possible. Well, it says a third of the stars of the heaven, so probably not referring to the stars of the woman's crown. But you brought up a really good point, and I'll just kind of pause to say this. What you just pointed out is a really important lesson in interpreting Scripture, is that when you use symbolic language, a lot of times the symbol is used to mean multiple things. And sometimes it's used to mean multiple things within the same passage. You know, so stars, you know, the stars here, when we talk about the crown that the woman has, is probably referring to the sons of Jacob. But here, the stars are probably referring to something else. So they could be physical stars, or they could be words that are symbols for other things. I take it that these stars are symbolic of angels. And that's generally been the case of people's interpretation, that the tail swept the third of the stars of heaven and cast them into the earth. People have generally interpreted that to mean that when Satan fell, a third of the angels went with him. And we know that there are demons. We know that there are other demons that seem that, according to our theology, they obey Satan. He is their king. And so that's generally been how that's been interpreted. So it's interesting that expression that he cast them into the earth, because they don't come with him. He throws them down with his tail, and so that's a weird way to describe, you know, demons that are eventually going to serve him. And we could probably get pretty deep into that, on why there's that description. If we should assume that the action described, because it's they are being cast down by his action, does that mean that those angels that fell didn't have any say in it, that they were just caught up along and they didn't actually want to rebel, but they were just brought down in the fray? Or is it a description to say that maybe Satan's deceit and his lies were so powerful that it was like he threw them down? Or is it describing that his actions when they obeyed him were so wretched and sinful that he destroyed them in his own destruction? I mean, there are a lot of different ways we could interpret it. But the force certainly, if just looking at it on the surface, it certainly seems like they're maybe more sinned against than sinning. Which, again, when you're using symbolic language, you have to be careful to not load too much of a burden on specific things. But anyways, he sweeps a third of the stars, that he casts them down into the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman about to give birth, so that when she gives birth to the child, he should eat it up. Okay, so we've got the child now. The child is plainly named. Who is the child? Okay, so but the woman is Israel and the child is Israel also? Good question. I like that. That's a strong answer. I like that. Jim, any theories? Okay. Well, let's look at the description and see if we can get a better guess. And was given birth a male son, which is really funny, the language right there, a male son. Because if you look at it in the Greek language here, a male son, what verse is that? That's verse 4. And it's funny because the word son is already male. It's already a masculine word, right? It's not like there's the word for son is huios or huios, and the word for daughter is thugater. So it's not like they're similar words that you might be confused by. So she gives birth to a son. That should be enough. But why a male son? Arsen, which is clearly means a man. It's not just like a general word for man that means a human. She gives birth to a male son. Okay.
See, when you take notes, it kind of spoils all my big surprises, right? Okay, so, but, no, but we, okay, so if we look at that language, she gives birth a male child, she gives birth a son. Go with me to Isaiah chapter 7. So when we look at Isaiah chapter 7, we see that she will give birth to a son and we'll call him Emmanuel, meaning God with us. That's generally the interpretation, that this right here refers to a male child, a male son. This I just read out of the NLT. I don't have my Hebrew text in front of me or a Bible that isn't the New Living, but she gives birth to a male child, and that is the reference that people – do you have the King James with you, Deanne? Yeah, why don't you check 7:14, because I think it says their male child, Isaiah 7:14. Okay, so there is a place I thought that was the passage. I thought that was what I had in my notes earlier. There is a place where he's called a male child. And I thought it was there in that passage. Let me check here, verse 5, Isaiah 66:7. That's what my Greek Bible tells me. I need to check Isaiah 66:7. Jerusalem gives birth to a son. Okay, that's not it. A man-child, okay, well, I'd be interested to see. I don't have, like I said, I don't have my Hebrew text here in front of me to find out if that, I could walk out to my office and get it, but I'm not going to because I'm lazy. Yeah, okay, yeah, that's okay. But there is a place in the Old Testament, like I guess I can just say this far. There is a place in the Old Testament that uses that expression, a male-child, and it stands out, and so the general interpretation among almost everybody is that this male child is Jesus, right? We have the expression a male son, which seems redundant, but we've also seen some stuff that seems redundant. Israel is going to create a child, and not only is this a male son who's about to be given birth to, but he's about to shepherd the nations with a rod of iron. Okay, well, again, that's a direct reference to Psalm chapter 2. Psalm 2, you know, kiss the son lest he be angry. We know that he's going to rule the nations with a rod of iron. But I do want to point this out here real quick, which is he's about to shepherd all the nations with an iron rod, with a rod of iron. That's a really interesting expression because normally you don't read it as he's going to shepherd. Right? Normally, you see that he will rule them with a rod of iron. And the reason why we see these two expressions is because in Hebrew, one of the words for shepherd is indistinguishable for the word for rule, or one of the words for rule. There are several words for both words, which, amazing, you know, in ancient agrarian economy, they have multiple words for shepherd and multiple words for rule, right? So when you look at most English translations, it's always he will rule them with a rod of iron. Greek doesn't have that ambiguity. Greek makes you make a choice between rule or shepherd. But here, John has gone with shepherd. And so it's just really interesting that he's gone with that understanding of this passage. But we've already seen this passage here. We've already seen that he's going to rule them with an iron rod. We've seen this in Revelation. We'll see it, I think, three times in total. This expression is used in Revelation. The first time we see it, we actually see it in the discussions about the churches. The one who overcomes, I believe it's in one of the overcoming parts, but the description is that the church, they themselves are going to rule with a rod of iron. If you look at chapter 2, chapter I'm sorry, chapter, yeah, 2, chapter 26, or verse 26. And the one conquering and the one keeping my works until the finish, I shall give to him authority upon the nations, and he shall shepherd them with an iron rod, like the clay vessels are shattered. Like I also have taken from my father, I shall give to him the morning star. Okay, so wait a second. So we've got a reference to stars here. We've got a reference to this passage. And what is Jesus saying? Jesus, here in the beginning of John's, the apocalypse, he is saying that the ones who are going to shepherd with an iron rod, not in keeping with it with Psalm 2. In Psalm 2, it's the Messiah who's going to do this. But what he's saying is that whoever overcomes, the one who's conquering, he is the one who is going to rule with an iron rod. And what happens is, in biblical theology, here's what we see. So in the earliest parts of the Old Testament, we see God is promising a redeemer. They don't know what the redeemer looks like. Well, from the biblical text, we don't know what the redeemer looks like. We just know that he's going to be a redeemer. Then we get a little bit further, and we kind of figure out a little bit from Genesis that there's going to be a blood sacrifice, that somebody's going to die for sin. Okay, then we go a little bit further, and Moses tells us that, and also with Abraham, we find out that he's going, all the nations of the world are going to be blessed through the seed of Abraham, who is the Messiah. Moses tells us that there's going to be a prophet like him who comes. David tells us that David is told, and we're told through David, that there's going to be a son of David who's going to rule the world. The Davidic Psalm, which is Psalm 2, you know, talks about the future messianic king. Now, as we progress further and further, we see in Isaiah, clearly we see that this Messiah is going to be a suffering servant. A lot of the Psalms tell us that as well. But as we progress all the way to the New Testament, what we see is this messianic ruler is going to be a world ruler. There's going to be a worldwide empire. And that's pretty universal through Daniel, Zechariah, Ezekiel. Ezekiel talks about the prince. Daniel talks about, he has a vision of Christ and talks about the great world ruler, whether it be, you know, the stone that becomes a mountain. There are other descriptions. And then we get to the New Testament. And what does Jesus tell us about the Messiah in the New Testament? Well, his servants, the apostles, the disciples, they want Jesus to rule. They ask him during his earthly ministry. They say, at this time, you know, when are these things going to happen? Because Jesus in, Mark 13, Matthew, the later chapters of Matthew, I always get confused if it's Matthew 24 or Matthew 26. I think it's Matthew 24. We have these descriptions of the apocalypse. I think it might be Luke 21 or 22. Don't quote me on that. But the disciples say, well, when are these things going to happen? And when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming? So they believe firmly that Jesus is going to come. And John the Baptist, notice John the Baptist's question to Jesus. English translations do a really bad job with this. So John the Baptist, when he's in prison, John has already declared Jesus to be the Messiah. And John asks Jesus a question. Are you the one who is to come? If you actually look at the Greek verb tense, it's are you the one who is to come, or should we expect somebody else? Well, most English translations, or at least a good number of them, say, are you the one who was to come? That's how they do it. But that's not what John the Baptist asks. John asks, are you the one who is to come? And it might be that what John thought was, well, Jesus is the suffering Messiah, but there's going to come another one who's the ruling Messiah. At least that's one of the interpretations out there. So anyways, they're trying to figure this out. But Jesus is dropping little hints throughout his ministry that when he rules, and he will rule, but when he rules, it is going to be his disciples and his apostles through whom his rule is carried out, through whom he executes his rule. Well, then what happens? Well, we go through, and Paul tells his apostles, or he tells the churches, he says, look, you guys have these fights in the church. You guys are going to law. You're suing. Christian is suing Christian and going to unbelieving courts to do this. And he says, appoint even people of low standing in the church. Even if somebody's a nobody in the church, appoint them to settle disputes rather than taking your disputes before the secular courts. And Paul gives a reason for this. He says, don't you know that we're gonna judge angels? Like we will be responsible for judging angels. And so we have this, so we get these expressions and we get others, and then we get into Revelation and we see Jesus saying that he's making these promises that they're going to rule with a rod of iron. Where do we see the 24 elders? They're sitting on thrones. We see there are other, you know, there are, like I said, there are hints of it through the Gospels. You take charge of 10 cities. You take charge of 5 cities. We see hints of it here and there, but now in Revelation, Jesus is clearly telling his saints, if you are faithful to me, I will give you the right to rule the world. It's not just going to be Jesus ruling. He is going to execute his rule through his followers. And so there's a conflation. So what happens is Psalm 2 gets expanded way out. Psalm 2 in the Old Testament, we say, well, that's Jesus. Who's going to rule? It is Jesus. How is Jesus going to rule? Through his church. Jesus is going to rule through his church. How do we know it's his church? Well, because he already made the promise in Revelation chapter 3 that whoever obeys him, whoever conquers, and those are members of churches, right? They're the churches of Asia Minor. Whoever in the church obeys him, they will fulfill the prophecies of Psalm chapter 2. So you guys with me so far? Let me recap real quick just to make sure we're all together. Right here in chapter 12, we come to this place where in verse 5, the woman who we believe is Israel, and I think can make a solid case, and I don't think there's a good case against for anything else. Israel is about to give birth. The dragon, who is Satan, wants to gobble up the child. So all of this fits with Jesus really well. All of it fits with Jesus really well. And the woman gives birth to a male child. Okay, that reminds us of the expression used. I think you're probably right, Deanne. I think that's probably the expression that's used in Isaiah 66:7, where the King James translates it man-child, but she also gives birth to a child. So we've got Isaiah 7, we've got Isaiah 66. We've got these promises that are being made. And what we see is the male child, which is about to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Or he's actually shepherd. I shouldn't say rule. He's about to shepherd all the nations with a rod of iron. And again, that is a literal fulfillment. It's just a direct quote from Psalm chapter 2. But we have a problem. All of this points to Jesus, but we have a problem. John, the Apostle John, in this book, has already quoted this passage. And that passage is referring to the church. So that's weird, but it's not a really strong argument yet. It's a really interesting argument. Well, wait a second. Well, okay, but we still got Psalm 2, so it's a little weird that John's kind of mixing and matching here. But okay, let's go with it. Well, then he gives another description, and her child was snatched away to God. Snatched away to God. Now that is a really interesting word. Why is that really interesting? Well, the word is harpazo. It's the Greek verb harpazo. Now, harpazo is used, I think, about 14 times in the New Testament. Normally, harpazo just means to pull somebody out of something. Generally, it's to pull somebody out of something where they're in a state of danger. Now, when we look at this child being snatched away, and clearly the child is taken to heaven, so there are 1, 2, 3. There are 3 or 4 places where three places for sure where the word harpazo is used to mean a teleportation, like where somebody is somewhere and their whole body is physically moved through supernatural means. The first is in Acts chapter 8, where Philip is speaking to the Ethiopian eunuch, and then the Ethiopian eunuch can't see him because God has harpazoed him. God has caused him to teleport, and Philip shows up miles away, right? Which I've always said, I wish that were my spiritual gift, that I could teleport, right? I could save so much money on gas, but God does not let that be my spiritual gift, you know? But keep praying for me. Paul tells us to eagerly desire the greater gifts, you know? So I'm holding out for that one, right? You know what? I would try to find a way. I would do my best. I don't have tongues, so maybe I can have teleportation, you know? So that would be wonderful, I think. But we have that passage, right? So that's one of the places where harpazo was used to mean that. We have two uses in
2 Corinthians. So if you remember 2 Corinthians, Paul is talking, he's talking about himself, he doesn't say it, but he's debating between the super apostles, the people who were telling the Corinthians that they were better than the apostles, that they were super duper saints. And Paul says, let me tell you about a man who was snatched away to the third heaven. You guys remember that? And he says, whether he was snatched away in the body or out of the body, I don't know, but what, this is what I do know. He saw things that man is not allowed to tell. That's the word that's used, is harpazo. So it's used to talk about Philip being transported. It's used to talk about that. And there's a third use, and this one, the other one Paul uses, is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, where he's talking about the rapture. Okay, now, I think I've mentioned this before. There's a pastor in town who has told me, he's like, well, I don't believe in the rapture. Okay, well, that's dumb, right? the word harpazo means something. But however you want to interpret 1 Thessalonians 4, the dead are going to rise first, they're going to meet Jesus in the air, and they're going to be with the Lord forever at that point. So it means something. You can't just say, well, I just don't believe in 1 Thessalonians 4. Well, I mean, I guess you can say it, but you sound like an idiot if you say that, right? You accept all the other things in the Bible, you just don't like that chapter, so you reject it. That's foolish. Okay, so we have three places where that's used. Now, Jesus is never described as being the recipient of the verbal action harpazo. He's never described that way. And in fact, right here, and I've translated it harpazoed with the ed because it's a passive verb. But that's not how Jesus is described. So when Jesus goes up to heaven, what's it described as? He ascended. He ascended into heaven. That is not the same thing. Harpazo means to pull somebody out, to physically grab them and seize them. And a lot of times it's a word meaning to take somebody out of danger. Generally, I think that's generally the word that's used. That's why a lot of times it's translated seized. In fact, there are a couple places in the New Testament where that's the meaning of the word. Jesus ascended when he chose to ascend. That the verbal force of this does not in any way match what's happening here. So this almost certainly can't refer to Jesus because that doesn't at all fit what happened to Jesus. Okay, so now we've got, so the male child is about to shepherd the nations with a rod of iron. The only other use of that in Revelation is referring to the church. The child is snatched away. Paul is clearly in 1 Thessalonians 4 describing that as something that's happening to the church. Now, but we can maybe fudge and say, well, you know, John's just using this word uniquely, maybe, possibly. And he's snatched away to God and to his throne. Okay, that preposition to, it's the Greek word pros. When you look at the word pros and the word thronos, so thronos means throne. See, it's, you guys can do Greek too, right? Thronos means throne. It doesn't mean toilet. You know, I don't know if you guys call it, the throne, but, you know, that's where kings sit too, I guess. So thronos is the throne. Pros means to. There is only one place in Revelation where the preposition pros, meaning to, is used to connect the word throne. It's right here. Now, Jesus is talked about, Jesus and the Holy Spirit are talked about in reference to the thronos many times. There are places where it could be God the Father or it could be Jesus that are just described as the one sitting upon the throne. Epitethrone, upon the throne, or epituthronu. I forget if it takes the genitive or the dative. It doesn't matter. So upon the throne, the one sitting upon the throne. Sometimes it refers to Jesus. Sometimes it says the one sitting upon the throne and to the Lamb. There's a whole cluster of those uses in the middle chapters of Revelation. So there's those sitting upon the throne and to the Lamb. And that's a pretty common expression. Then we have the expression where Jesus, when he's talking to the churches, he says, as I sat down in the throne, in my Father's throne. So he actually uses the word in, and I think that word in is used a couple times. Now the Holy Spirit, it receives the preposition enopion, which means before or in front of. So the Holy Spirit is like the seven lampstands that are upon or they're about or in the front of
the throne, enopion, the throne, before the throne. That the Holy Spirit is described that way in a couple places where the Holy Spirit is enopion, the throne. In fact, I think that's the only preposition that describes the Holy Spirit in reference to the throne. Now we've got angels and people that are around the throne, kuklo, which is where we get the word cycle, kuklo, the throne. So they're around the throne. And we have before the throne, we have other prepositions. Only one place do we have the word pros, meaning to or towards the throne. He was taken to the throne. And Jesus is never described as going to the throne. He's described as in the throne or on the throne or upon the throne or the one sitting upon the throne and the Lamb, meaning that either that could be interpreted two ways. Either they're giving worship to the one who's upon the throne and also giving worship to the Lamb, or they're saying to God the Father and God the Son because they're both sitting upon the throne. You could interpret that either way. There's a rule in Greek called the Granville-Sharp's rule. You know what? We're not going to go into that. But there are different ways to interpret that. But here's the thing. Never is Jesus described as going to the throne in Revelation. And actually in any of John's literature. Mostly because John only uses the word throne in Revelation. He doesn't use it in any other book. So that makes it a little bit of an easier study. But there are if I remember right, I was doing this earlier. There are 37 uses of throne in the Revelation. And so that seems really strange that would be the only place that it would be given. And we look at that and we say, okay, well, wait a second. This seems really strange because the woman gives birth to a male son. That makes sense for Jesus. That makes a lot of sense for Jesus. But he's about to shepherd all the nations with the iron rod. John's only used that to describe the church. He's not used that to describe Jesus. The child is snatched away. That word is never used to describe Jesus by any author. So it'd be really strange for that to refer to Jesus. And he's taken away to God and his throne and to his throne. That's never used to describe Jesus. Why would Jesus be taken to the throne? He would be taken upon the throne, but why to the throne? That's a really strange expression. And then we run into bigger questions. So we ask, well, who can fit these? If Jesus can't fit, who is described as ruling with a rod of or shepherding with a rod of iron and being snatched away and being about the throne? I mean, nobody else is described as being to the throne, but Jesus is always on it. There are other descriptions of people who aren't Jesus and their relationship to the throne. Well, the church, the 24 elders, they're described this way. So then what do we do with verse 6? So the woman fled into the desert where she has a place prepared from God so that he should nourish her 1,260 days. Now hold on a second. Hold on a second here, Lukey Poo. If the woman flees into the desert where she has a place prepared for her for 1,260 days, 1,260 is a rather specific number. That doesn't sound like a number that is symbolic of something. That sounds like a number that's actually a number that refers to an actual period of time. So if the woman gives birth and the child is snatched away and the woman flees into the desert where there's a place prepared for her to nourish her for 1,260 days, if the child is the church, that means that after the rapture, the woman is going to flee into the desert for 3.5 years. That fits exactly perfectly into our timeline of Revelation. And it fits perfectly into where we are in the Revelation. Because this brings us up to speed. This tells us, wait, what has happened in the last chapter? Well, if you believe my interpretation of it, the end of chapter 37 has been that the Jewish people have turned to Christ. Which means they have rejected Antichrist. Which means now Antichrist is going to make war on Jerusalem. And what do we have in the next chapters? We see Antichrist is going to make war on Jerusalem. So this brings us right up to speed. This tells us, hey, there's the rapture. The child that Satan wanted to eat up is taken out of the world.
That's the rapture. That's the snatching up. And the woman, which is Israel, she flees into the desert. When does she flee into the desert? Well, she flees into the desert after the abomination of desolation, or after she chooses to turn to Jesus. There are a couple different ways we can interpret that. I'll admit this. But this time frame fits the tribulation. This 3.5 year time frame, this 12, go ahead, Deanne. That is an excellent question. So if you're listening at home, the question is, why are we bringing up the rapture here when we're already 3.5 years into the tribulation? Great question. I don't have a good answer for that. I really don't. That's a question that bothers me. I've thought through that, and I don't have a good answer. And I haven't really found anybody that does. Somebody may have a good answer, but here's the problem. If it's Jesus, we run into the exact same problem. Why is the birth of Jesus mentioned here either? That's one of those questions that, go ahead. There are people who would believe that. No, that's fine. Yeah, so there are people who believe that there are people who are going to be raptured at different times, that it's going to be several. Yeah, I don't know that there's anything I can point to and say that absolutely can't happen, but if that were to be the case, I feel like 1 Thessalonians 4 would be a little more explicit about it, and it's maybe, like I said, if you don't want to be a pre-tribulation rapture person, the only other position that really makes sense, and I don't think it's a strong argument, but the only position that really makes sense is the pre-wrath, the pre-wrath view. Not mid-trib is a version of I'm sorry, pre-wrath is a version of mid-trib, but pre-wrath actually I think makes sense of why it would be a mid-tribulational rapture. You could do that, but I don't think that makes sense because Israel's promises were never promises that they would have a celestial inheritance, that they would go to heaven. Israel's promises were in the here and now. And when we look at Ezekiel 38 and 39, the wars of Gog and Magog, and we look forward into Revelation, the people of Israel are still there. So if all Israel is saved and all Israel is raptured, who's Antichrist attacking? Who's Antichrist making war on? And so, you'd have to change so many interpretations. At least it wouldn't work with my system. It might work with another, it could work with others, but here's the problem. There's an expression they use in law. You're probably familiar with it. You've heard the expression, an argument proves too much. Okay, so for those listening at home, an argument that proves too much is an argument that actually can be used against whatever you're trying to contradict or refute, but it refutes everything, right? Like, Ben Shapiro just talked about this, I think it was last night, but he said, you know, people are talking about sanctions, economic sanctions. They're like, well, we can't use sanctions against Putin now because then we don't have sanctions to use against him later. We've only got one bullet in the chamber, so we can't use it now because then we can't use it later. Well, Shapiro points out quite rightly that that's an argument that proves too much, because by that logic, you can never use the sanctions because you don't have them as your whip hand anymore. So I think that's the same thing here, where people say, well, if this is the rapture, why are we hearing about it here in the course of Revelation? Shouldn't that have happened at the beginning of Revelation? Sure, I mean, that's a problem, but it's also a problem if it's referring to the birth of Jesus. So it can't mean the birth of Jesus by that same logic. It's an argument that proves too much. But that is a good question, and it's one of those questions that people in my side can't answer. There are answers. I don't find them particularly satisfying. But the problem is that everybody has to answer the same question and nobody really has a good one. It's like John has been going chronologically through the entire book and all of a sudden we're not being chronological anymore. All of a sudden we're getting a flashback. Really hard to understand why. Why are we getting this flashback? But also it's probably fair to say a little bit that the flow of Revelation changes a little bit. We're in the seventh trumpet now. And the descriptions begin to change. It becomes more of,
It becomes less of a list of events and more of kind of a novel. We have characters that are fleshed out a little bit more. So that might have something to do with it. It might just be an artistic touch from the Holy Spirit and from John. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it could be. It could absolutely be that this is a reminder that the church has been taken away, that the church has been protected from the wrath of the dragon. I think that would, if that is, I mean, I certainly think that's probably part of the answer. We have this, and there's an interesting phrase here. Skipping ahead, we're not going to cover this tonight because we're actually already over time. But if you look at the end of verse 17, we see, whoops, I'm sorry, I had that page upside down. And the dragon was made angry at the woman. This is going to take us a while to get there, but the dragon was made wrathful upon the woman and passed away to make war with the remaining of her seed. Okay, so if the woman is Israel, she has remaining seed. She has other children. Well, who are her other children? Well, her other children are still on the earth. So probably unlikely that this is referring to, I would say that's a defeater. That would mean that Israel, if all of Israel is saved and Israel or a large part of Israel is raptured here, that would make a lot of sense. But it's possible that could be what's happening. But I would say it's unlikely. But there are, especially because we look at what this other description, the ones keeping the commandments of God and having the testimony of Jesus. So the only way that could work where the rapture of the male child is referring to believing Israel that's been saved is if the remaining of the woman's seed are unbelieving Jews who will come to believe in time. But that conflicts with what we've already interpreted at the end of chapter 11. And then that runs into the problem of, but they're the ones that keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. So shouldn't they also have been raptured up? So I would point to those as being reasons why it can't be it can't be a reference to Israel being raptured. We're already over time tonight, so I'm not gonna go into that. But verse 6 is really interesting. We're not gonna get into verse 6 tonight. I don't know that we're gonna get when we start getting into verses 6 through the end. It might take us next week to cover all of this material, or we might be in this material for another couple weeks. It's really hard to know how this is going to flow. Just because tonight we had, I feel like, not as much conversation as I would have liked. It was me talking more, but we did talk a little bit, and we threw out some ideas and wrestled with them. So it'll just depend on that. But do you guys have any other questions before we wrap up tonight? Any concerns? All right. Well, thank you guys for your time, for your faithfulness, and I pray that God will richly bless you.